So welcome. My name is Sharon and I serve the village's education lead. And this, I know you already know Shariah, but this is Shariah Armstrong. And I finally learned to say it correctly. She's going to be talking about the paideia method. I got it right. I had to write it out phonetically or else I was going to mess it up. So welcome, yeah. Shariah.
Thank you.
And we're interested in what you have to share.
All right. Awesome. So the paideia method has a lot to do with establishing community so that we can have difficult conversations. So if we could get started trying to build a little bit of community. There's a game that we'll do. So if you want to clear your laps, probably sit a little bit forward in your chairs. And we'll begin practicing together, and then there'll be a little twist to it. So do you know Jack and Jill? So the line.
Okay.
Yep. Ready? Jack and Jill went up the hill to fetch a pail of water. So it goes like that. Okay, so we'll do it again. Ready? Jack and Jill went up the hill to fetch a pail of water. Jack fell down and broke his crown, and Jill came tumbling after. That's it.
Okay.
So now we're going to go around the circle. I'll start, but I'll say one word, and then you pick up the next syllable. And so it goes by syllable. So, water.
Okay.
And we're going to try to get all the way through. Ready? I have a feeling this group is going to do it. Yeah.
Okay, here we go.
Ready? Jack and Jill.
Jill.
Good. So, Jack and Jill went up the hill.
Okay.
Okay, here we go. Ready?
Jack and Jill went uphill to
fetch
a
pail
of
water.
Jack. I can't do this at the same time I'm thinking what I'm going to say. That's my issue.
All right, we're going to give this another try.
Okay.
We're going to get through.
Okay,
so
all right.
Verse 2.
Let's
Jack
focus here. Here we go. Ready?
Jack
and
Jill went
hill
two. Okay, here we go, team. Ready? Jack
and
Jill
went
hill
two.
Fetch
a
pail
of
water
and fell.
Oh.
There is no and, sorry.
Jack fell. Okay, let's try again. Ready?
From
Jack
and
Jill
went
up
hill
to
fetch
the
pail
of
water. I should say water.
Sorry.
No, you had it.
Okay.
Okay, this is important, team. We're gonna
get
this through this time.
Okay.
Here we
so
go.
After water,
so
and then it's Jack.
Water. Jack
fell
down.
Okay.
I gotcha.
Okay.
Ready?
Okay.
Jack
and
Jill
went
up
hill
to
fetch
the
pail
of
water.
Jack
fell
down
and
broke
his crown.
And
Jill
came
tumbling
after.
Yay!
So what can we learn about group dynamics from this activity?
Don't have old women in your
team.
If you have a cheerleader, it works better.
Oh, good. Because having a cheerleader helps.
Sometimes I was thinking too far ahead.
Yes. So can you think about how that relates to discussions?
Well, then you can't be where you're supposed to be because you're jumping ahead.
Yeah, so sometimes we're too busy listening to what the other person is saying and then trying to come up with what are you going to say next, and then you forget to listen to the rest of what the person was saying. So that's a good piece of insight. What else?
Sometimes something metaphoric about being in sync with each other.
You don't want to make a mistake in front of other people.
Yeah, right. So feeling like what you're doing needs to be right or correct. Or, I mean, sometimes there's feelings of wanting to, like, back out, too. Like, this, you know, I'm just not saying anything because I don't think what I'm going to say is right, so I'd rather just sit it out. Mm-hmm. Would we have been able to complete the task if one of us decided not to be a part of it?
Not the same.
Right, it's not the same. Yeah. So we'll carry that with us. So part of the Paideia method is to do these coaching activities with your group just to get the idea that everyone needs to be involved, everyone is a participant. Without one person's voice, it doesn't work. You know, and then continually, every time you sit down for Paideia discussions, you do more coaching. So it's the idea that in conversations, we can't just assume that everyone is adept at having conversations. Like, it takes a lot of skills and a lot of building those skills. And so even, you know, as adults, there are plenty of us that don't feel comfortable in conversation. So thinking about today, the role that you play in conversations. So when you are at the dinner table, for example, what is your tendency in a conversation? You know, do you tend to monopolize? Is it hard for you to get a word in? You know, what role do you play? So we'll be setting a goal for ourselves in the conversation today. So think about that role that you normally play in conversation. So what would you like to work on improving? You know, so if I'm the person that monopolizes the conversation, perhaps my goal is going to be to hang back a little bit and give other people a chance to have their voices heard and being mindful of that. So think now what it might be for you. And then we'll just write that on the back of our name tent as a reminder.
So I was just commenting before you got here about how difficult it is to teach with these boots on. So it's like carrying a little extra weight. Okay, so to begin with, what is dialogue?
So another coaching activity, if you had to choose a definition for what is dialogue, what would that definition be? So think about your definition, take a second to formulate that, and then just write it down. So what is your idea of what is dialogue?
So since it's a cozy group, I think I'm going to pull up a table here instead of standing.
So I'll begin. So my definition is dialogue is the search for truth, and we all hold a piece of the puzzle. How about yours?
Dialogue is two or more sides exploring perspectives and possibilities together around an important issue.
Very good.
I think dialogue is a back and forth conversation with roughly equal participation from all parties.
Right on.
Yes, thank you.
Given a conversation with two or more people, give and take, respect for all.
Okay, very good. Was there something that someone else said that you thought, oh, that's a good point? Or, oh yeah, I wasn't thinking about it that way?
I was thinking about it just in terms of, like, conversation, not necessarily a search for truth or mm-hmm. a way to understand people better, but I like that definition a lot more. It seems a lot deeper, and like it could apply to more than just a conversation.
Mm-hmm.
I like your aspect of respect.
Very good. So this is the definition that Google will give you. So dialogue or dialectic conversation
is discourse between two or more people holding different points of view about a subject but wishing to establish a greater understanding through reasoned arguments. So in Paideia, the big focus is on that desire to hear and understand the opposing perspective. So in a lot of our dialogue and a lot of what I see when I'm in classrooms observing teachers is a focus on argumentation, but more to debate and prove that your point is the correct point. Paideia is to just develop a greater understanding of the topic. So your biggest job is to understand where the other people are coming from, not to prove that your point is correct. Although you are still using logic and reason, but it's not a debate. It's trying to create a greater understanding. So in Paideia, if you can think of the metaphor of a campfire, and all of our ideas get added into this campfire, and we stoke up the fire bigger and bigger, and then eventually in the end, we all have a much greater understanding of the topic. And so it's the seek for truth, or the search for truth. Paideia, the name comes from Greek origins, meaning the upbringing of a child. Mortimer Adler was the educational psychologist that developed the Paideia method and formed the Augsburg Paideia group. And Paideia is a dynamic approach to teaching that combines ideas and methods rooted in Socratic teaching, redesigned to address contemporary challenges in education. So what do we think about contemporary challenges in education? What might that mean? So in the days of Socrates, if they were to sit around and have conversations and, you know, just labor for hours over the meaning of a text, is that similar to our contemporary needs for our children and schools and for our universities?
I don't think so.
No.
Like, can you see our students just like, you know, class is over and we're gonna pick this up in the coffee shop across the street because we are enthralled. So
yeah, first of all, they don't read texts.
Right, yeah. So getting them to do the required reading.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, much less getting them engaged with the required reading. What are some other contemporary challenges?
I think there's a sense that people realize that their children are individuals, but the school system, especially public school system, is kind of teaching to a mass, not an individual. And so an individual child they might not be getting what they need educationally because the school system is teaching something either a level too high for them or a level too low for them. There's almost no individualization in the way that people teach,
right?
At least in public school.
Mm-hmm. So differentiation for the different levels of students within the same classroom. I mean, in our urban classrooms, we have kids that are sitting in their 11th grade class with the second grade reading level. And in that very same classroom, you've got a kid that's going to Notre Dame next year, you know. And so how do you level the playing field for all students in that room? Paideia is a method that can work for all of them, because the perspective that student that may have a second grade reading level, the perspective that they have from their home life might be the perspective that no one else in that room has. And so if we can use our voice in a conversation as part of our learning, that levels the playing field for that child. So some of the most difficult students that we have in the classroom really get into discussions because they're like, oh, this is something I can do, you know? And some of your lowest performing students academically are the best when it comes to the hustle of conversation, you know, being able to argue a point, you know, because for some of them it's a survival technique, you know, from where they're coming from. So Paideia is awesome for that. Contemporary challenge, like you mentioned, just getting them to read the text. You can't have an in-depth Paideia conversation unless you've read the text. You know, it's a requirement. And so getting students engaged with topics that they really care about in the classroom, like choosing that perfect text, is going to be paramount for this. But I haven't seen any other methods in the classroom that work better than Paideia when it comes to getting everyone in the class involved. It might mean you're going to do like Tupac changes, you know, like you might be doing rap lyrics, you know, but you can still get some great historical content and social justice themes and just very, very rich text by choosing a text that every student or different students in the classroom will be into. So what is Socratic teaching? It's asking and answering questions, and we always just choose an idea to focus on. So these ideas then will transcend different parts of their real life. So bringing whatever it is we're doing in the classroom, bringing whatever it is that we're reading in this text, and then having us in this room be able to apply it to our lives. So themes or ideas that we are all, that mean a lot to us. Can you think of themes or ideas that will transcend? So they mean a lot to us. They would mean a lot to anyone else in the village. They would mean a lot to high school students. What are different things that just matter to humans? The environment. It could be one, yeah. That's definitely a theme that can transcend different social groups.
Having a relationship with someone?
Relationships, absolutely. Those basic needs.
Yeah, I'd probably echo the environment as far as I think that's one that really transcends lots of people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What about belonging? Like a sense of belonging, love. You know, so Paideia discussions are centered around not a piece of curriculum that needs to be taught. Mm-hmm. They center around ideas, big ideas that affect everyone. So that it's not just discussing a topic within a classroom, but they can see we can all see a direct link into our real lives. So that's the buy-in piece of Paideia. You know, it should be real and meaningful. All right, so let's take a look at this. What is the current situation of public discourse? So the verbal exchange of differing perspectives in America.
Hollering at each other.
From a really great distance across a huge gap.
And holler, I mean, whether that's posting someplace or whether it's just gotten so.
Right.
All it is to me, it's not.
Are there specific examples that, like, without naming names or getting too personal, but just examples from life of when the public discourse has been yelling?
Well, I think of social media, which really isn't yelling, but it feels like it is, you know. And it's, you know, posting. I mean, people post and respond to people they don't even know, and it's just so beyond me. It's just like, why would you even take the time to do that with somebody that you don't know or care about, or I don't know. So it's just this throwing something out, and you get thrown something back.
And people just being interested in, like you said, shouting their own opinion and not caring that there might be another perspective or how to learn the other perspective. It's around gun control, around immigration, around tariffs and trade.
Yeah.
I don't know how long you've been out.
Yeah. So,
In your personal lives, like with friends, like friend groups, are you able to have civil discourse about the political climate?
I think for me it's easier with my friends than with some of my family members, because I tend to choose my own friends, and we have some things in common, and so I can feel like I can talk to them, and we may have similar opinions. With some of my family members, we have differences in opinion, but the good thing about having a discourse with a family member is you know that they will love you even if you disagree. I think there's a little bit of fear in a friend-type discussion or with a colleague or something like that, that if I say the wrong thing, if I have an opinion that they don't like, that it will change the way they think about me. And apparently that means a lot to me,
right.
What they think of me.
Any other examples of how that's playing out in real life?
I think most of my friends think pretty much like I do politically, which I don't know what that says about me, but that's what I saw. But I have a group of three other friends, or four of us, that do lots together. We've known each other forever, and one is, we love her to death, but she's much more conservative thinking than the three of us. So we cannot talk politics, because for one thing, we like her so well, we don't, and then it's like we would gang up on her. It just wouldn't be fair, because it just wouldn't work, and we don't want to, ruin the friendship. So we just steer away, and we all do. Every once in a while, someone will, can't help themselves. If something really awful has happened, you're like, and then you're like, oh, I should have said that, and then you back up, and then you go. So that's sometimes can be uncomfortable, but we haven't found a good way to handle it other than don't talk about it.
Right.
I'm not sure that's the best way.
Yeah.
But.
So Paideia as a program, the number one tenet was developed to help people become engaged democratic citizens, so to be able to have an exchange of differing viewpoints, gain a greater understanding, and hopefully try to work together, So if I had one wish, it would be to get our, different parties in, Congress and get them all together and teach them some methods on how to get along. Because the fear is we can't get these sides together and just start working together. Well, that's a collapse of an empire. So this method is trying to get people like you and your friends, like some kind of a method where we can come together and have these really difficult conversations. So Paideia centers around a text. So instead of getting people together and say, what do you think about gun control, and where then people, it's going to be about you and your argument, and you're going to become the target of, whatever you're saying, When you use Paideia method, then you can use the text, and the text is the center. So everything that comes out of that discussion around that idea will come from the text. So that's the premise of Paideia, and we'll try that today. So I took a list at a training with teachers a couple weeks ago of what came out of that same question. So what is the status quo of civil discourse in America? And so the themes that came out, I'm just curious if they're close to ours. Growing more divided, us versus them kind of mentality. The either or fallacy, so everything is, you're either in this camp or that camp, and there's like no in between. So you're either an out of touch libtard, this is their words, not mine, or you're racist, misogynist, and a xenophobe, and there's kind of a real sense of there's no room for compromise. Another one was, that we communicate on Twitter using rhetorical sound bites in place of civil discourse. Lack of empathy or understanding for differing viewpoints. And then routine denial of the merits in alternative positions and or flaws in our own arguments. So exactly what you said. So, my argument is great the way that it is, and I'm not going to take the time to consider yours. And so that's what we're working against and trying to find ways to move past it. So Paideia is a strategy to help future generations to learn face-to-face dialogue once again. So this is a quote from Barack Obama. For far too many of us, it's become safer to retreat into our own bubbles, whether in our neighborhoods, our college campuses, or places of worship, or our social media feeds surrounded by people who look like us and share the same political outlook and never challenge our assumptions. So a lot of that research that, you know, we hang out with everyone that believes just as we do, and, you know, because of the different algorithms on Facebook, we see only the things we want to see and we defriend the rest. And then there was a quote in the New York Times about Senator McCain, and it refers to Paideia. So McCain still believes that Paideia is essential for democracy. Paideia is based on the idea that a healthy democracy requires a certain sort of honorable citizen, that if we are not willing to tell one another the truth, devote our lives to common purposes, or defer to a shared moral order, then we'll succumb to the shallowness of a purely commercial civilization. We'll be torn asunder by the forces of extreme polarities. We'll rip one another to shreds in the naked struggle for power. What do you think about it? Any thoughts on the quote? Do we see truth? Want to push back?
It's exactly what's happening now. I mean, it seems like so much of the rhetoric swirls around the persona of Trump, and either you defend everything he does or you denounce everything he does, and there's no other camps. So yeah, we're ripping one another to shreds.
Has it been, like, have you been thinking about ways that you can bridge the divide in your personal lives? Or has it been, you know, a hope that it will just resolve itself, it's just a phase we're going through? Or is there just too much on your plate to think about it?
Well, sometimes it just seems so hopeless that...
And everybody's so entrenched. Nobody's interested in hearing.
Yeah.
Well, a Republican or a conservative might say the same thing about...
Yeah, well, I said everybody. Yeah, everybody's so entrenched. Like, neither side is interested in the other side because the other side is just dead wrong.
So, a definite need for Paideia. So we talked about this earlier. Paideia is not about arguing to prove your point. It's about listening to the opposing viewpoint to grow a greater understanding of the issue. So since practicing Paideia, I've changed a lot on how I handle conversations. It used to be definitely all about a debate. And now I really am focused on, okay, so like I just need to understand, you know, where are you coming from, and just putting that focus very intently on understanding that other point of view. The trick is to get people in a room to have that conversation or in a place where, you know, they're willing to engage. So be thinking about ways that you can put together opportunities for these kind of discussions. So text selection when we're doing Paideia is, again, it has to be around some kind of universal theme or idea, something that everyone can talk about. It certainly does not have to be political. It should be a good read. So if you aren't really interested in reading it, it definitely shouldn't be a text that you choose. Challenging, genuinely interests the group, and contains an issue arguable from multiple viewpoints. The goal is to understand how others have come to drastically different understandings of the world from that of your own. Civil conversations filled with questions stemming from genuine curiosity from all perspectives, not questions intended to prove the other person wrong. And we're trying to reach that greater understanding. So let's give it a try. So we've talked a lot about what Paideia is. So let's go ahead and get started. So you've got a little reading guide to begin with. The pre-reading question number one is, why do people build walls? list and number as many ideas as you can. So without doing any of the reading, just making yourself a list. Why do people build walls? And that can be any kind of wall.
And as soon as you have a few ideas down, you can go ahead and get started with the initial reading of the piece. So number two, this is during reading. As you're reading, cross mending will leave annotations, so questions, connections directly related to the text in the margin. So interact, try to at least every 4 lines or so, either draw connections to your life, different things that you're wondering. Could be any kind of words that you think are key or patterns that you're detecting. So when you get through your reading, there are a few questions for number three. And don't worry if you don't know the who, what, when, where, why. That's what the discussion is all about, is to help each other through the text. But just to jot down some ideas for the questions in number three, just to help get your bearings on the text. And we'll get started with our discussion in a couple minutes. So we'll go ahead and get started. To begin with, it's important that everyone is on a level playing field as far as background knowledge that we might want to bring in to this text. So is there anything that you were using, any prior knowledge that you were using to decode? Like, is there any information that you know about Robert Frost that was helping you to understand this poem? Or, is there anything that was essential in your understanding that the rest of us should know before we get started? Follow-up questions to deepen the conversation. I'm not allowed to be part of the conversation. So to begin with, the opening question is, what is one thing that you didn't understand about the text? So we can go ahead and just popcorn it out. So just one thing that you didn't understand about the text. And no one has to answer that question for you. It's just putting it up there. What was one thing you didn't understand?
I was confused about the hunters part of it. Like, what does it mean? The work of hunters is another thing. He comes and repairs the wall, but the hunters somehow destroyed the wall in their pursuit of the rabbit. I was wondering how they did that, why they did that, why in particular a rabbit hunter would want to tear down the wall, et cetera, et cetera.
So, there is no obligation from the group to answer the question, but does anyone have ideas they'd like to throw out?
Well, it might be that there was a rabbit hiding in the wall, and they took the stone out to find the rabbit, and then didn't bother to put it back.
Hmm. That's a lot of effort for a rabbit.
This is true. That's the only thing I could think, make any sense of. But I'm not sure that's right. But
and I don't even know if this guy was writing about England or about North America. But I was envisioning these British hunting parties on their horses. Way too many of them, like, running around and making a mess of people's properties.
Uh-huh. I didn't understand the very first phrase.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah. I had to rewrite it.
And
I rewrote it to somewhere there is someone who doesn't like a wall or love a wall. Because I couldn't, I'm just like, it doesn't make any sense to me.
It's a weird sentence.
Yeah, okay.
And so the author chose not to write someone there is that doesn't
I'm
love
sure
a
there,
wall.
Yeah. And it just bothered me. I had to rewrite it.
I'm not sure what that says about me. Well, were you thinking like, things don't love.
Yeah. And then something there didn't. Yeah, so that was my biggest hang up.
I think he uses that same line again, like
yes.
in the poem in 35, and it made sense to me
it's
in line 35,
interesting.
And it didn't in line 1. Line 1 is a weird way to start your poem, so that it gets people immediately questioning what does that mean.
Yeah.
And then it gives all that context, and then in verse 35, in line 35, it makes a little bit more sense to me. But I'm with you. That first line is...
oh, yeah.
So what do you think then was meant by something there is that doesn't level well? So you said in line 35 it makes a little more sense.
Yeah.
How do you think it was used? Like, why do you think the author chose that line?
I think once he's doing this little conversation in his head with his neighbor, trying to convince his neighbor, put a notion in his neighbor's head, and he's asking, what was I walling in or walling out, and who am I going to give offense to? Is there something there is that doesn't love a wall but wants it down? And so he's almost talking about there's a force out there in the world, whether it be these human hunters who are removing it because it's an impediment to their hunt, or if it's the earth that causes things to erode.
Mm-hmm. And the weather.
Mm-hmm.
Frozen ground swell.
Mm-hmm.
The upper boulders in the sun. Almost like he's saying, like, the fate of a wall is to eventually crumble. And why the heck do we keep fixing it?
Mm.
And I think the key part is in 23, which is also the very middle verse. We do not need the wall. And then he says, Jogi, ha ha, maybe my neighbor's worried that my apple trees will come over and eat his pine tree. I think that's hilarious.
I do think that in 23, he's not totally discounting the need for a wall. He says, there where it is, we do not need a wall. So maybe he's not wholesale against walls. He's just thinking, in this particular zone, there where it is, we do not need the wall.
Because if they had cows, they'd
need
the wall.
What's that
if they had cows, they'd need the wall.
Right?
Yes. Yeah.
That's what he says, where there are cows, but here there are no cows.
So it's like you need a good reason, but they don't really have a good reason.
Yeah.
Right. And every year or every so often they do this stupid task
yeah.
again. They walk the whole line of the fence and they fix it. And a year later, it's like this repetitive nonsense.
Yeah.
Why do we bother?
Yeah.
And his neighbor is convinced that it's not futile, that it serves some kind of purpose. Maybe it's the only time a year they actually talk to each other.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Hmm. Yeah, I guess you could read that good fences make good neighbors in a couple different ways. You could hear him saying good fences make good neighbors because it keeps us in our own area and stops us from having conflict.
Mm-hmm.
Or in the light of it's the thing that brings them together once a year to mend the fence,
mm-hmm.
making a good fence makes us good neighbors because we're interacting with each other. Could be read probably more ways too, but
so according to the poem, are walls good or are they bad?
This particular wall seems to be pretty pointless.
But don't good walls make good neighbors?
Mm-hmm.
Or good fences?
I think he's trying to contrast one way of thinking with another way of thinking. And their received wisdom, the wisdom of the ancients, because he says he will not go behind his father's saying, you know, like we've been doing this for generations.
this is what we've always thought, this is what we've always believed, good fences make good neighbors, so let's just keep it up. That's like, we have to have a nuclear arsenal because it will prevent nuclear war. And so we keep up with the arms race. Because that's what people thought in the 60s, and we're still doing it. It's too political, maybe. But something is true because we've always said it's true.
It's interesting to me that the narrator is the one who initiates the mending of the fence. He's the one who lets his neighbor know that they should get together and walk this line and mend the wall. So in a way, the wall is, in the way the narrator doesn't think that the wall is a bad thing necessarily, because he's the one who keeps getting together with his neighbor to mend it, but he also seems like he understands that the wall maybe ought not to be there because of this something, this force beyond his control that keeps breaking the wall. I felt like in line 14, there's like a real sense of like longing and resignation in that word, set the wall between us once again. To me, that seems like he's regretting that it has to be that way.
Mm-hmm. And if they didn't fix it, pretty soon it wouldn't be, right? It would just fall down.
So what if the one neighbor said, yeah, you go right ahead. I am so sick of keeping up with this wall. You knock yourself out. Then things would be out of balance, right?
Yeah, and the wall would be like half as big as it was, or you'd have to get stones from elsewhere because half the stones fall in the neighbor's land.
Right. Or that neighbor would have to go to the other neighbors to retrieve the rocks and do both sides.
Do you see any significance in line 19? Stay where you are until our backs are turned.
The spell on the rocks. Like they're wagging their finger at you. Stay where you are! Yeah, it's the status quo, right? I think. Maintaining the status quo. Don't mess with what we've always done.
There's almost a sense of resignation in that as well. Like, we know that these rocks are going to fall off again because some of them are shaped like balls. They're not going to stay put. So at least stay where you are until we're done with this section of the wall. Don't do it right in front of us and embarrass us.
Yeah, don't remind us of the futility in the moment. I think this has to do with ingrained patterns of interaction that neither side is willing to walk away from.
It ends with the line, good fences make good neighbors. Do you think that that's true?
It's the only lens through which this futile, recurrent task makes any sense.
Sit in it, sorry.
It's the only lens
through which it makes sense to keep rebuilding this dang thing that keeps crumbling every year. So it's the justification for their folly. If building walls that keep crumbling can be perceived as folly.
I mean, there are times they help, but not all the time. Are they needed, is how I would say it.
What would be some examples of...
If you have dogs. I mean, I'm just thinking, we're, you know, okay, or little kids, or... I mean, but there needs to be a reason.
Yeah, that was good to think about.
But I'm not sure it's the fence that makes a good neighbor, but... So you could look at it that way, too.
Are there examples of fences in your own lives that you can think of? Like, being really literal, you know, like growing up where there are fences, you know, around your homes, are there current fences, are there metaphorical fences?
I have a beautiful example from the house that we currently live in. We moved in there in 2008, and we bought it from people who had yappy little dogs, so their whole backyard was chain link fencing, right? But the house is kind of on a slope, and the windows out of which we looked the most looked upward kind of on the slope, and then at the top was all this fencing, and it felt like I was living in jail. Fences, like so high up. And the first weekend, we ripped out those fences. We do not have yuppie dogs, and we hated those fences. And it felt so good. And the neighbors were like, oh, not planning to have any dogs? Nope. And then one side of neighbors, as they were watching us, they said, we still have a dog. We know it's your fence. But if you cut it down, like, our dogs won't stay in. Can you leave our side up? And that is still my dispreferred side of the house because it's so ugly. So then I built a great big flower bed around it and against it to kind of hide it. So they have the ugly side. Yes, fences can be awful. It made me feel like I was living in jail.
And that brings us to the question, what is the intention or the purpose of the fence? Is it to keep something in or to keep something out?
It does not keep deer out, I can promise you that. They can leap so high. They still eat my vegetables.
So are there any other walls or fences that you can think of in real life?
I feel like I have a wall up at work, like who I am, and being myself is easy at home with my husband. And then there are just certain parts of my life that I don't talk about at all at work because I think that people will treat me differently if they know things about me. And so I keep up a lot of walls, and I feel like I wall off one particular part of my life so that only a few people are allowed access into that part of me. And it makes it kind of hard. It makes me feel like I'm lying to people a little bit at work about who I am, because it's a big part of who I am, but I have to pretend it doesn't exist at work for fear of being treated differently. So, in that case, I think it's both a good wall because it's protecting me. That was one of my answers for number one. Walls protect people and things that are important to them. Mm-hmm. And so, with that particular wall, I'm protecting myself, but I'm also doing myself a disservice because I can't be honest with people. They don't get to know the real me and what I really want out of my life and that kind of thing. It's doing them a disservice too, because if they knew me better, they would, I don't know, not to toot my own horn, but if they knew me better, they would think I was great.
Such a cool person.
Yeah. It's hard to talk on such general terms, but
I was also thinking about how, in a metaphoric sense, we often encourage people to establish boundaries, which is kind of a wall thing, like, well, it's very unhealthy not to have boundaries. Like, don't say yes to everything. Or don't let people get away with saying whatever they want to you or about you. So why am I so against walls with this poem? And I'm really in favor of boundaries.
Well, it probably depends on how you phrase it. Like, wall seems so permanent, and it has a negative connotation in today's world. Like, build wall, keep those people out.
Yeah.
That kind of thing.
Or hitting a brick wall, yeah.
And a fence is sort of, that's like a neutral term for it, I think. And boundary is like, yeah, that's good, everyone should have those.
Oh, yeah.
Depends on how you term
the
thing. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's interesting. The word wall is different than it was 2 years ago. Right. Who'd have predicted that?
Right. So, well, that's the final question. So is it human nature to build walls between individuals, societies, or nations? What examples can you think of in your life? You already shared some of those, the world or throughout history. Is it inevitable to build walls?
Some degree. Yeah. I mean, I think of walls of a house. Well, those are good for the most part, right? Or even in a house. But, yeah. But they keep people out too, right? You know. Mm-hmm. But.
Well, walls can make it better for the people inside. You know,
yeah.
No weather, no intruders, no.
Yeah.
Voyeurs. But maybe in the peaceable kingdom there won't be walls. Because all, you know, the lion will lie down with the lamb, so you don't have to put a fence around your lambs anymore. I'm thinking about the EU. Borders were so important in old Europe, you know, countries and kingdoms and armies. And then they went on this wild leap of geopolitical faith and came up with the EU, and it's kind of sort of working. There hasn't been a war in Europe since World War II, which was a really long time for Europe to go without a war. And so the very thing that was part of the definition of war, which is intruding upon one another's territory because there's a border. If you remove the border, like, how cool is that?
So we think
and you could say the same thing about neighbors, because, you know, some neighbors it's really important to know where that line is between two homes or
mm-hmm.
what, and others, it's not a big deal, right? So it's kind of interesting to think about that. And, you know, is that why they put the fence there? I mean, I don't know. And I get why it can be, I mean, you know, but it, so
yeah,
that's interesting how people view that differently.
In the U.S., these property boundaries are very permeable and pretty much kind of just a visual aesthetic,
yeah.
Not a wall.
Right.
Like you see in so many other places.
Yeah. You know, and then, I mean, I grew up on a farm out in the country, so it was a very, fence was a very different reason.
Mm-hmm.
You know, keep the animals in or, you know, whatever, but.
But you don't fence around your alfalfa field.
No.
Because
no.
Who cares?
No, exactly. So it was, you know, and we didn't really care about, I mean, the neighbors were so far away, there was nothing about that. So, you know, so I don't
know. Well, before we bring our seminar to close, does anyone have any last minute questions? Anything that you're still wondering, with, like, clarification on?
Can I ask something about the selection?
Oh, sure.
Yeah, okay. It seems to me that there was so much gray in this. I mean, that's on purpose, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. So text selections should be things that, you know, like a gem. They've got a lot of different ways that you could look at it. So a lot of different facets. If there were more people in the room, this is the smallest seminar that I've ever held, you're going to get a lot more perspectives that come into the conversation. And it's a lot less work for the people that are in the conversation to come up with all the ideas, you know, and so then one person's idea will lead to someone else's, and then, you know, light bulbs will go off. You know, I think we had a successful little conversation, but it's, you know, intentionally ambiguous, you know, and the idea is that we'll all help each other come to a greater understanding of the text. I've done this seminar probably half a dozen times, this particular text, and it has always come to a very deep conversation about Trump and the wall. So, but, you know, and I tried to lead you there a little bit, but, you know, that's just not where this conversation went. That's totally fine, you know. If, you know, if we were in a group and it was a group that had been, you know, having some tensions over that issue in particular, and you sat them down in a circle to have that conversation, but then still people stayed away from it, then there would be some kind of like post-reflection, you know, that went with it. So maybe I would say like, okay, you know, before our next parent meeting or, you know, whatever we are together doing, you know, think about, you know, how this topic relates to the current struggle or tension that we've been having in this group. And then, you know, do a little reflection on that, and we'll revisit that the next time we get together, you know. So, I mean, the purpose is to try to get people to talk about stuff that, in their real life, that might be hard to talk about, and you do it around a text, so now it's about the text, it's not about that issue or about that person anymore, you know. So, the text that we have for Thursday is Baldwin's A Talk to Teachers, and that one is, I mean, deals with race, and it's a really super heavy piece of text. So I planned this one just as a practice text, so it's not nearly as, I mean, people don't get nearly as upset about it. But, you know, hopefully we'll get some more people and have a really good conversation about, you know, the Baldwin text. Any other questions about, you know, like why the text was selected or anything that you're wondering?
Well, before you said about James Baldwin's letter to teachers, I was thinking, I wonder if perhaps poetry or fables or allegories would work better than nonfiction.
Yeah, and we use that all the time.
Yeah, and I could think of some other pieces that would just be really cool.
Yeah. Fables are great ones. And cool too, because you can use them with like little kids and adults too.
When you've done this text before, how does it usually fall out whether or not people think, when you ask the question, is it true that fences are good?
Mm-hmm.
How does that usually shake out when you've had this discussion?
It either people will go directly to like getting really upset about the wall, and then I have to play mediator. Like, remember our rules, and just we are here to focus on the text, and so I'll try to bring people back to that. But it's also an awesome way to build community. So people will often talk about, like, when I was a little girl living back in Cambodia, and, like, they'll just bring in their examples, and so then people start to view each other as humans, because we all have childhood experiences, and, when they share their memories and you remember your own, and, so there's been some really beautiful moments of, like, I'm presenting at a conference or something from teachers all over the place, and then by the end of our hour-long session, like, we've already built community because of that sharing, of our personal experience that will connect, because these are, all ideas that connect all of us. We all have some kind of experience with fences and boundaries, and, in our schools, when you've got, students from a lot of different backgrounds in the room, like, especially if you've got, our DACA recipients in the room, there, it will always lead to, a deep conversation about Trump. Mm-hmm. And then in that situation, my job is to, like, well, let's look back at the text first, so we have to, like, get a good understanding of the text before we can lead to talking about Trump. But it will lead them there, and then we get to have that conversation, whereas, before the text was there, it was, like, not an option to be able to do it in a civil manner. Mm-hmm. And think about how it would change, if our objective is to talk about really difficult political topics, so, like, the wall, how would that conversation look different if we brought in, like, an article, for example, instead of a text like this? Would we be able to be civil in our conversation?
Probably not.
Right, yeah. And so, and maybe, depending on how much practice you've had, maybe this wouldn't be so civil either. That's why it has to be a group committed to, having a civil conversation to gain greater understanding rather than we're going to have a debate.
And it's kind of like, in this case, that's all they've ever known, right? I mean, it's just always has been there and they haven't asked why. I mean, so you could relate that to the wall, too, in the sense of they just think it's going to work. I mean,
yeah. Well, and
somebody said it was going to work, so
right.
That's... and really haven't kept asking
right.
Why.
Or, like, the logistics of, like, will it actually work?
Right. I mean, how much will it cost and who's...
Yeah.
I mean, no one's asked.
Yeah.
Well, they have, but not enough people. And
yeah.
Then there... But there hasn't been a... They might have asked, but then there's no discourse back.
Yeah. And, we've had great conversations on the aspect of, like, when the wall does come up, Trump's wall, who are we keeping and who are we keeping out? And then it will lend itself to the logistics of,
yeah.
Like, is this actually...
The walk right here every spring.
right.
Yeah, that's
yeah.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Huh.
Yeah, the hunters will come and knock it down, and they're going to get through, and we're not going to see when it happens. We're just going to come
yeah.
back in the spring
no,
and rebuild
no.
it again. Yeah. Yeah. Well, thank you for being a part of the discussion, and happy to answer any questions that you might have.